This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 4th. I'm Max Pringle. Coming up, the World Economic Forum wraps up in New York City. Hundreds are arrested. Congress calls off Enron hearings when Ken Lay backs out. And 10,000 demonstrate in Munich against the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. These stories and more coming up on Free Speech Radio News. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Denise Kovalchuk with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Bush unveiled a $2.13 trillion budget today to spend on the war on terrorism while cutting money from key domestic programs. Joshua Chaffin reports from D.C.
President Bush said last week in his State of the Union address that he'd spend whatever it takes to win what he calls the war on terror. He also told the American people to prepare for a budget deficit. Bush blames the war and the economic downturn for the federal cash shortfall, but others on Capitol Hill point to his 10-year, $1.35 trillion tax cut. The budget he delivered today would cut spending for environmental and social programs. Congressional Democrats and others claim the White House is raiding Social Security to pay down the deficit. The Bush budget counts on $1.2 billion in revenue from leasing of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to oil drilling. President Bush is asking for $11 billion over 2 years to protect against bioterrorism and $7.8 billion for missile defense, a program that has been condemned by America's allies as a threat to world peace. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
For the fourth time in 12 months, the United Nations has appealed for emergency aid for Palestinians in the occupied territories. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, says it needs $117 million right away to give food, medical services, and short-term employment to families in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The agency says thousands of Palestinians have lost their livelihoods because of Israeli closures imposed on their communities. And 29 children enrolled in UNRWA schools have been killed and another 800 injured in the past year and a half of conflict. UNRWA plans to spend $5 million on extra classes and trauma counseling. Prime Minister Tony Blair's remarks of calling public employees wreckers has angered union officials. Anastasia Kershaw reports from London.
Tony Blair has been attacked by one of the largest unions in the UK for suggesting that workers in public sectors like health and transport are wreckers. That is, they're opposed to investment and reform in the public services. The remark was made in a speech yesterday and appears to point towards unions and the Conservative Party. The union, GMB, is so angry that it's launching an advertising campaign to defend its workers. Ian Duncan Smith, leader of the Conservative Party, called on Blair to stop the blame game and take responsibility for changing the system. Duncan Smith also upbraided the government for its unclear messages that public workers are heroes one minute and villains the next. This is Anastasia Kershaw reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
Teachers in Maryland are giving a performance assessment test failing grades. Ellen Ratner filed this report.
Several teachers have come forward in Maryland to protest the grading criteria used for the state's performance assessment program, which they believe is symbolic of a nationwide problem. The essay-based assessment program in Maryland determines which schools receive increased funding according to student performance and improvement. Teachers are then forced to correct the tests by looking solely for keywords instead of considering the actual content of the essays. The teachers feel that this sort of grading puts more emphasis on obtaining results instead of considering the student's improvement. Peggy Salazar, the principal of Oakview Elementary in Silver Spring, Maryland, agrees with the teachers' complaints.
It's a total disrespect for the answers that they've written, that no one is reading them thoroughly.
These complaints parallel other discussions around the country concerning the effectiveness of aptitude testing. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Ellen Ratner.
And today, the American Academy of Pediatrics has announced its support for the rights of gays and lesbians to adopt children. Rita Sand has more.
Although a few states allow gays and lesbians to adopt their partner's children, the majority leave it up to state courts or prohibit these adoptions altogether. The AAP would like to see that changed. They hope their 55,000 members will work to promote legislation that will result in more security for those children living in same-sex households. The AAP says allowing a child either born to or adopted by its gay parent to be adopted by their partner improves the child's safety net, granting them rights to such entitlements as health care, inheritance, and child support payments. The number of children with at least one gay parent numbers in the millions. All 300 children of gay parents surveyed in this month's issue of the Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics showed normal emotional, cognitive, social, and sexual development. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rita Sand in Chicago.
I'm Denise Kovalchek for Free Speech Radio News.
The chairman of the powerful Senate Commerce Committee today said he would force former Enron Corporation chairman Kenneth Lay to appear before his panel and called for a special prosecutor to probe the failed energy giant's ties to the Bush administration. Frustrated by the last-minute refusal of Lay to testify today before the committee, Senator Ernest Hollings launched into a critique of administration officials who he said had worked as advisors to the company. Robert Knight reports from Washington.
The chairman and the ranking member of the full committee and myself and the ranking member of the subcommittee met and discussed the word we received late last evening that Mr. Lay would not be attending the committee hearing this morning. We decided that we really had no choice but to issue a subpoena to require his attendance, and we will do that tomorrow at a meeting of the full committee. I regret that he's not coming to the committee at this point. We had been told for over a month that he was going to be available, was anxious to testify. We were told that on last Friday and last Saturday.
Lay's cancellation followed two developments over the weekend: the release of a 218-page Enron board report, which concluded that Lay, Enron President Kenneth Skilling, and Chief Financial Officer Andrew Fasto skirted ethics guidelines 2 years ago, resulting in the concealment of $1 billion in losses and the self-enrichment of senior executives through lucrative private partnerships. The other development was Lay's characterization as the head of a, quote, culture of corporate corruption, quote, by Commerce Committee member Byron Dorgan. The North Dakota Democrat, who received a combined $6,000 from Enron and its accounting partner, Arthur Anderson, and the implied threat of, quote, going to the pokey for this, end quote, from the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, Louisiana Republican Billy Towson, who himself received $63,464 from Enron Anderson. Thus, Lay's absence was understandable to Russell Mulkiber of the Washington-based Corporate Crime Reporter.
The surprise was that he agreed in the first place, and it's just embarrassing, and he shouldn't have agreed in the first place because there's an ongoing criminal investigation. And when there's an ongoing criminal investigation, the defense lawyer doesn't want his client up there testifying.
Still, answers are needed, according to Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen, who decried Lay's absence.
It's pretty outrageous that he decided not to testify. I mean, he was not under any obligation to legally, but ethically, he absolutely has an obligation to start explaining himself and his actions and the actions of his company in an unscripted public appearance.
But according to Mulkiber, lawmakers should look towards legislation which would prevent double duties for auditing firms hired to both monitor and consult on the fortunes of their clients, as Anderson did for Enron.
What they should be doing is figuring out how to prevent this kind of thing in the future and leave the mopping up operation to the ongoing criminal investigation. Of course, that's the more difficult task for a two-party system that's heavily influenced by corporate America, because any serious reform will be vetoed by those who are donating heavy money to both parties. But what's the more serious reform that will prevent this kind of thing? Creation of a separate corporate accountability commission that will actually appoint the auditor. So it takes it out of the hands of the company. The company can't hire and fire its own auditor. That's the bottom line conflict. That's not being discussed on Capitol Hill.
Russell Mulkiber is editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. In the Capitol, I'm Robert Knight for Free Speech Radio News.
About 200 people were arrested outside the annual meetings of the World Economic Forum held in New York City at the weekend, mostly on disorderly conduct charges. The forum brings together thousands of top corporate and government leaders and other power brokers. The group normally meets in Davos, Switzerland, but moved its meetings to New York, reportedly in a show of solidarity after the September 11th attacks. But some officials say it was because of the rising security costs of dealing with protests. And as John Hamilton reports, the World Economic Forum proved to be just as unpopular in New York as it was in Davos.
We all know that here today at the World Economic Forum, the corporate elites who think they run this planet are having a giant schmoozy cocktail party. Will we say no? We say no to corporate rule.
More than 10,000 marched on the World Economic Forum this weekend as the elite global body met behind police barricades in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Demonstrators calling for an end to the annual meetings crammed into protest pens set up by 4,000 police assigned to protect the forum. Inside the meetings, nearly 3,000 of the world's wealthiest corporate and political leaders dined on caviar and champagne while discussing issues of global trade. Outside the meetings, thousands of demonstrators snaked through the streets of Manhattan in a carnival atmosphere.
We billionaires have ruled the country from behind the tinted windows of our chauffeur-driven limousines, and we're out here today to reclaim our power. Now everybody's come out of the closet. We're coming out of the wealth closet because we think it's really important that these rabble stop crashing our party.
Even if the participants of the World Economic Forum are united by their wealth and power, they are often split on policy issues. U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill triggered a heated discussion among the forum's participants when he suggested that Argentina, and not the International Monetary Fund, was responsible for the collapse of that country's economy. And Secretary of State Colin Powell received a cool reception from many at the forum with his tough rhetoric on the need for the U.S. to expand the so-called war on terrorism. Outside the forum, calls for peace were as plentiful as calls for economic justice. And Eliza Caballes marched on Saturday with other Filipino rights activists who fear that the war on terror is spreading to the Philippines.
It has definitely spread to the Philippine Islands, and it's always been there. And the justification has been like a group of Abu Sayyaf, which is consisting of 100 people. And they're in a remote island that is just the excuse to exterminate like a lot of progressive movement that's happening in the Philippines that's completely anti-imperialist and anti-globalization.
Among the thousands of corporate executives, venture capitalists, and politicians at the weekend meetings were a small number of participants from labor unions, human rights groups, and non-governmental organizations. Julian Filikowski of the Catholic Agency for Overseas Development was among those trying to engage the World Economic Forum.
In order to get corporate business and government to take on our agenda, we have to talk to them and tell them what our agenda is. And so far in the discussions I've had here, I've found people very attentive.
None of the thousands of people who took to the streets this weekend were interested in cooperating with the World Economic Forum. Dino Pantelukas of Teamsters Local 707 scoffed at the notion that organized labor's views were represented in meetings at the Waldorf Astoria.
Well, quite frankly, it's nonsense. The people who are in that building, the corporate leaders, have been responsible for the driving down unionization rates in the United States in the private sector to 9%. So, you know, you figure it out for yourself. It's nonsense.
For North Americans in the anti-corporate globalization movement, all eyes now turn to Alberta, Canada, where the G8 is preparing to meet in June. Protests there are already in the works and promise to be at least as loud as those at the World Economic Forum last weekend. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Hamilton in New York.
In Munich, 10,000 demonstrators defied the city's ban on protests over the weekend to oppose NATO and the Munich Security Conference. Inside the conference, delegates representing the world's political and military elites discussed the possible next steps in the so-called war on terrorism and the expansion of NATO in Europe. Meanwhile, on the streets, people discussed the corruption of democracy and how to end the war. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Patrick Beckett files this report from Munich.
Nein zur NATO, nein zum Krieg, nein zu eurer Politik. Nein zur NATO, nein zum Krieg, nein zu eurer Politik.
Almost 850 people were detained for up to 48 hours, and 47 demonstrators were arrested on the streets of Munich this weekend. Police say they had 3,500 officers in Munich to maintain security. But on Sunday night, police admitted there was very little property damage and violence over the course of the weekend. This directly contradicts claims by police late last week that as many as 3,000 demonstrators intent on violence would be in Munich. Their argument led to the city canceling all permits for demonstrations. 10,000 people defied the ban and took to the streets to claim their democratic right to demonstrate their opposition to NATO. This woman from Berlin, who declined to give her name, was concerned about civil liberties.
What I really think is really, really dangerous that they forbid the that we don't have the right to speak. I don't know if you heard about the action yesterday, how they passed out white papers and the police confiscated the white papers and the white sheets because they forbid to any kind of political speech.
The ban on the demonstration ushered in an ominous parallel to the security conference itself. It illustrates the desire to stifle popular resistance to government policy. Ironically, the ban may have encouraged more people to demonstrate in defense of their rights. George Jacob, who was detained on Saturday night for taking part in an illegal demonstration, explains.
Just says that the right to demonstrate in Germany doesn't mean that much when the Minister President Stoiber has really high interest in keeping his town safe when he's running for chancellor in Germany. So I don't think it was fair to make it an illegal demonstration.
Edmund Stoiber is a minister in the German government, representing the right-wing Bavarian Christian Social Union. He has recently become the leading candidate for German chancellor for the National Christian Democratic Union. Because there was no officially designated demonstration location, throughout the weekend, small and large groups of people gathered spontaneously in different parts of the city. The heavy police presence necessarily created confrontations, and at times tear gas and pepper spray were used on the crowd. But Konstantin Wecker, a well-known musician in Germany, says the concern over violence was misplaced. Speaking at a press conference on Sunday, he explains.
Übrigens interessant, ich habe nichts dagegen, dass und ich finde es auch richtig, dass sich München schützen möchte vor Gewalttätern.
I think it's okay that the city of Munich wants to defend itself against violent people. But in my opinion, it would have been good not only to close the roads, but also the airport and send the majority of the participants of the security conference back home. Because who, I ask you, is violent if not a country at war? War is violence. And that's the reason why I wanted to go to the demonstration and protest against NATO policy.
War was one of the main topics inside the official security conference. U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz told the over 200 conference participants that the war against terror is not over. He then said that Iraq could be the next target. This was sharply opposed by Russian Defense Minister Ivanov and German Defense Minister Rudolf Scharping. Scharping went on to warn that the U.S. is showing a lack of willingness to share the struggle against terrorism, except on its own terms. In Munich, I'm Patrick Beckett for Free Speech Radio News.
The immediate threat of war between India and Pakistan may have been averted, but tensions between the two nuclear-capable neighbors are far from over. India has rejected the latest Pakistani peace proposals. Cross-border shelling in the southern part of Jammu and Kashmir occurs daily, as are reports of skirmishes between Indian security forces and Kashmiri militants. The state itself remains sealed off from the rest of India, with communications all but shut off. From Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, Sputnik Colombi files the second in a two-part series on what is still a tense situation in South Asia.
One measure of the changes taking place in the valley are the hints coming from the Hurriyat, the umbrella organization of Kashmiri separatist groups, that they might take part in elections in the state under certain conditions. Mirwais Umar Farooq, leader of Kashmiri Muslims and a former chairman of the Hurriyat.
Those elections would not be for creating a government in Kashmir, but that would be to ascertain the representative character of the Hurriyat conference. And obviously, as I said, there have to be certain assurances and guarantees from India that, as we said, that it should not be the ratification of India's position on Kashmir. Because there are people who say that as far as the representative character of Hurriyat is concerned, it's still not proved. So if we go for elections, it won't be an alternative solution to Kashmir.
According to Kashmir Chief Minister Farooq Abdullah, whose term runs out in October, elections could be held this coming September. But given the Kashmiris' bitter experience with previous polls, marked by widespread rigging and fraud, the prospect raises many questions and fears. The current situation in the state is not conducive to elections, says Bashir Manzar, editor of the Daily Kashmir Images.
India has to do a lot, Minister. People don't trust India anymore. India has been a promise breaker every time it has broken the promises. And particularly during 10, 12 years, Kashmiris have seen the worst and ugliest face of India on every front. So India has to do something. Minister has to tell people, convey to people and convince them that it really means business. It's really sincere and serious at this moment. And for that, it has to do something, homework before coming to
what could be two or three concrete measures it could do?
One is reduction in troops, which are everywhere and on all streets and markets, and get them out of those and put them in their bunkers and barracks, whatever. Number two is the human rights violations. If there are complaints of human rights violations, you book your people and make it public and tell people, see, this man has done this wrong and we have punished it, so that people, you gain people's confidence. And number three is economic front. Means economically, Kashmir is gone. It had tourism, it is gone. It has horticulture, it is not getting any money on this front. So India has to open up its means, these economic channels to help Kashmiris. And then let them start a dialogue with Kashmiri people. Let India come out with a bold statement that they are ready to talk to any Kashmiri group which is angry with, which wants to talk, which wants to discuss issues with India. And there are no conditions at all from either side.
The post-September 11th scenario, for various reasons, right and wrong, does seem to have opened up a window of opportunity. Retired Kashmiri educationist Aga Ahmad Ali says the best and sanest minds in India have recognized the changing dynamics of the situation in the wake of Musharraf's speech, and that it is India's turn to be fair to the Kashmiri people.
And they know in their heart of hearts that this is cumulative for having toppled Farooq Abdullah, for having arrested Sheikh Abdullah, his father. All the sins of omission and commission committed by India have come home to roost. Now is the time to... It is a creative moment in history. This is the time for India to behave like a great power. Be fair to Kashmir. Both India and Pakistan have a face, and it must be saved. Otherwise, soon, they will have no face to lose.
The subcontinent has seen enough bloodshed on religious lines, says Aga Sahib. Independence for Kashmir in the age of globalization and the untrammeled power of multinational companies, he adds, does not have the same implications as it did 50 years ago, when it could have been viable. People seem to have forgotten, he laments, that Kashmir saved India's secularism in 1947, and Kashmiris can do it again if they're given a chance.
I am for the substance of freedom, and Kashmiris can, we can, be proud of what we did in 47 and saved Indian secularism. We can do it again, support the stability that should be in India and Pakistan, and seek their friendship and becoming a bridge between the two, rather than carving out an idiotic independence for ourselves, which is not on the agenda of history at all. No country can be independent. Even America is not independent now. Multilateral companies are creating a new world. So there is really a tide now. And it would be very creative if Kashmir could become a bridge.
Sputnik Kilambi in Srinagar for Free Speech Radio News.
AIDS activists in South Africa have decided to import AIDS drugs in defiance of the South African government and the Patents Act. Antiretroviral drugs can prolong the lives of HIV-positive patients, and a recent court ruling means that South Africa can license companies to produce these drugs cheaply. Naeem Gina reports.
With South Africa's government dragging its heels on the administration of antiretroviral AIDS drugs, a number of independent initiatives are attempting to provide the drugs to AIDS sufferers. The two provinces not controlled by the African National Congress have already started their own pilot projects. And, in defiance of the government's position and the Patents Act, AIDS lobby group the Treatment Action Campaign and the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, have begun importing cheap antiretrovirals from Brazil. Last month, a delegation from the two organizations visited Brazil and began the illegal importation. The organizations are unrepentant about their action. Zaki Ahmed of the TAC.
The only law we're breaking is patent law, and we say that people's lives come before drug company patents.
The drugs, according to the TAC, are of a high quality and have been approved by South Africa's Medicine Control Council. They will be used as part of a pilot project in clinics run by Médecins Sans Frontières in the poor township of Khayelitsha in Cape Town. According to Toby Costa of MSF, antiretrovirals produced by multinational pharmaceutical companies are too expensive, and the generics from Brazil are being obtained at half the price.
For us in particular, where we run a medical project in Khayelitsha, this may enable us to place twice as many people on antiretroviral therapy.
The clinics currently serve 85 patients, with new patients joining the program every month. MSF, too, is unconcerned about the legal issues.
We have taken a principled and considered stand to put the lives of our patients before the patents and the profits of multinational pharmaceutical companies.
MSF, COSATU, and the TAC do not regard their importation as smuggling and have challenged pharmaceutical companies to exercise their patent rights. COSATU said another shipment of antiretrovirals is already on its way from Brazil, and the TAC has vowed to continue importing the drugs until the government decides to give it freely to all people living with AIDS. Zaki Ahmed.
We say to the pharmaceutical companies, give the government licenses now to allow anybody in our country to produce. And don't restrict it to companies, don't restrict it to the private sector. We don't care what you are going to do, but we will continue doing this because we're serving people's lives.
Zaki himself has made a personal commitment to the struggle for free antiretrovirals in South Africa. Although living with AIDS and able to afford the drugs, he has sworn not to use antiretrovirals until the government provides it freely for poor people. Some drug companies have offered to provide free supplies of nevirapine to the government to prevent mother-to-child transmission. COSATU and the TAC are obtaining the Brazilian drugs for adult administration.
After a mother gives birth, she still has HIV. She still needs treatment. And what we're doing in Khayelitsha is showing that sort of treatment is possible in this context, in a resource-poor setting in South Africa.
MSF's Toby Costa. In any event, the South African government has not yet accepted the offer of free drugs from the multinationals. Government claims it does not have the infrastructure for the drugs administration and that it has not been proven that the drugs are completely safe. Some people believe that these are not the real reasons and that President Thabo Mbeki's view that HIV does not cause AIDS is the reason for the government's clay feet on this issue. The TAC appeals to the government to get its act in order.
We are appealing to our government to issue compulsory licenses and to start pilot projects in our country across the provinces to use antiretrovirals. We know that the government can't roll out antiretrovirals everywhere, but we say to the government, as treatment for people, we say to the government to treat people, to save people's lives, start those pilot programs now.
That's Zaki Ahmed of the Treatment Action Campaign, and I'm Naim Gina in Johannesburg for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by more than 140 reporters on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. With the recent changes at Pacifica, we hope to reach a settlement soon. In the meantime, we continue to produce Free Speech Radio News. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. This newscast is produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and KPFA Radio in Berkeley. I'm Max Pringle. Thanks for listening.
I'm Rachel Maher in Melbourne, Australia. Free Speech Radio News is a vital part of global media activism, creating an alternative news network that strengthens and sustains the international movement for social justice. This broadcast only stays on air with your financial support. Please donate to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thanks for your support.